The story titled The Other Sean Byrne Doesn't Exist is one of the more quietly unsettling pieces in today's lineup. Score of 206, with 101 comments. The piece is about what happens when you share a name with someone else, specifically when the digital footprint of a common name creates false associations and genuine problems for the real person. The author is investigating a situation where a name collision across public records, social media, and professional databases creates a kind of phantom identity that shadows the real one.
This is an underexplored dimension of digital identity. We talk a lot about privacy in terms of your own data being exposed, but the name collision problem is different. It's about information from someone else's life being attributed to you because you happen to share a name. Background check databases, people finder sites, even LinkedIn's algorithms suggesting connections based on name similarity. All of these can create associations that are factually wrong and practically harmful.
The HN thread is full of people with common names sharing their own experiences, which is part of why it hit 101 comments. Several people describe being denied jobs, having incorrect criminal records surfaced in searches, or dealing with debt collection for debts belonging to a namesake. The legal framework for correcting these errors is poorly suited to the volume and speed of digital information propagation.
The Google homomorphic encryption post connects to this privacy theme from a very different angle. Google published a blog post explaining how they're making homomorphic encryption, which has been theoretically powerful but practically unusable for years, viable for real-world AI inference. Score of 409 with 249 comments. The core claim is that they've made enough efficiency improvements that you can run meaningful inference on encrypted data without first decrypting it.
For listeners who haven't encountered homomorphic encryption, the holy grail is computation on encrypted data. Normal encryption protects data at rest and in transit, but the moment you need to compute something, run a query, run a model, you have to decrypt first, which means the processor doing the computation sees the plain text. Fully homomorphic encryption, or FHE, lets you compute on ciphertext and get an encrypted result that, when decrypted, is the same as if you'd computed on the plain text. The problem is that it's been extraordinarily slow. We're talking several orders of magnitude slower than unencrypted computation.
Google's claims in this post are about closing that gap through a combination of algorithmic improvements and hardware acceleration. The HN thread is appropriately skeptical. Several commenters with cryptography backgrounds are asking pointed questions about what practical means in this context, what the specific overhead numbers are on real workloads, and whether the threat model that FHE addresses is actually the relevant one for most AI applications.
The suspecting a court of using AI story is one of those anecdotes that feels like a harbinger. An Ars Technica report about a litigant who, suspecting that a court or opposing counsel was using AI to process filings, injected prompt manipulation text into their own legal filings to try to influence the outcome. The HN comments treat this partly as darkly funny and partly as a preview of an adversarial dynamic that the legal system is completely unprepared for.
The prompt injection angle is legitimately interesting. If courts or law firms are using AI to summarize filings, and if adversarial litigants can embed instructions that manipulate those summaries, you have a new attack surface on the legal process itself. The authentication and integrity questions around AI-processed legal documents are going to need formal answers. And right now, the answers don't exist.
The Indonesia earthquake, magnitude 7.7, 68 kilometers north-northwest of Ende on Flores Island, struck today. Ende is a city of roughly 80,000 people on an island that sits on the Ring of Fire. A 7.7 at that depth and location carries real tsunami potential, and early reports indicated tsunami warnings were issued for parts of the Indonesian coast. The USGS page is the primary source, and the HN thread is tracking developments in real time. Our thoughts are with everyone affected.
The Egypt missile program piece is a historical story. The disappearance of Heinz Krug, a German rocket scientist who was helping Egypt develop ballistic missiles in the early 1960s, under circumstances that have long been attributed to Israeli intelligence operations. It's a reminder that the geopolitics of missile proliferation and targeted intelligence operations have a much longer history than our current discourse about them sometimes acknowledges.
The WCAG 2.2 Accessibility Guide is an EPUB and PDF. Debian voting on AI contribution policies and the ThoughtDAG context graph for LLM conversations all surfaced today. The Debian vote is particularly interesting. It's the first major Linux distribution I'm aware of that's formally attempting to develop community governance policy for AI-assisted contributions, which raises questions about code provenance, copyright, and quality assurance that every major open-source project is going to have to grapple with eventually.
And the E-Ink newspaper project, someone converted their RSS feeds into a custom newspaper format displayed on an E-Ink screen to stop doom scrolling on their phone, has 79 comments that are mostly people saying, "I want this," and asking about the hardware setup. It's the kind of joyful, personal project that HN loves.
Now, we promised a "What If We're Wrong" segment, and I want to apply it to the thing the HN community seems most certain about today: the consensus that Manifest V3 and Google's elimination of effective ad blocking from Chromium is straightforwardly anti-competitive conduct dressed up as technical improvement.
Play the skeptic.
The strongest counter-argument starts with taking the security rationale seriously. The old extension model, Manifest V2, gave extensions extraordinary power. An extension could intercept and modify any network request, read page content, inject scripts, and do all of this with effectively no oversight from the browser itself. That's not just a hypothetical concern. Malicious extensions in the Chrome Web Store were a real documented problem. Browser hijackers, credential stealers, adware, all deployed through the extension system. MV3's declarative model, where extensions declare rules rather than executing arbitrary code on network requests, genuinely reduces that attack surface.
So the counter-argument is that Google had legitimate security reasons to make the change, and the ad-blocking harm is collateral rather than intentional.
More precisely, even if individual engineers at Google knew MV3 would weaken ad blockers and were fine with that, the security rationale is substantively real, and this change benefits us in multiple ways, including one that's commercially convenient, isn't the same as, "We did this primarily for anti-competitive reasons." Courts have to show that the anti-competitive rationale was the dominant driver, not merely a beneficiary.
The weakest part of that argument, though, is the design specificity. uBlock Origins author Raymond Hill has been quite detailed about specific choices in the MV3 spec, particularly the limit on the number of declarative filtering rules that seem hard to justify on security grounds and happen to be exactly the constraints that break sophisticated ad blocking. If Google can't explain why those specific limits were set where they were, the purely technical defense gets weaker.
Exactly. And that's the signal to watch. If this ends up in litigation or regulatory review, discovery on the internal communications around those specific technical decisions will be determinative. Did anyone at Google model the impact on uBlock Origin during MV3 design? If yes, what did the models show and what was the response? Those emails, if they exist, will tell the real story.
The broader assumption to interrogate is whether market share in browsers translates to genuine leverage over the web's advertising ecosystem, the way the antitrust argument implies. Advertisers and publishers have alternatives. They could adopt more privacy-preserving advertising models. They could move to app-based distribution, where browser extensions don't apply, or in a world where Firefox gains share as the only ad-blocking browser. The ecosystem might actually rebalance. The argument that Google's browser dominance locks in its advertising dominance assumes a stickiness in user behavior that is real, but not permanent.
If we're wrong about the anti-competitive framing, what we should watch for is a meaningful improvement in ad blocking effectiveness on Chromium-based browsers through some mechanism other than Manifest V2 rollback, either through MV3 improvements, through browser-level blocking that doesn't rely on extensions, or through privacy-preserving advertising standards that make blocking less necessary. If none of those materialize over the next 2 years and Firefox's market share grows substantially, it will be harder to argue that the outcome was unintentional.